It is Monday, September the 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, gains for the far right in Germany's election.
You might reasonably think that this is the pinnacle of success for AfD and that it will decline from there.
Some believe the U.S. could be a loser in today's Kurds referendum.
Our argument that only we can keep Iraq united has fallen on deaf ears.
Also ahead, President Trump and a sports controversy, plus some really cool music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has won a fourth term in office, but Europe's most powerful leader will have to govern with a far less stable coalition in a fractured parliament after her conservatives gave up support to the surging far right. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Bruce Wilson, director of the European Union Center at the RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, for his read on the election win for Merkel.
First thing to say is that this is a remarkable result. This is a fourth successive election victory for Angela Merkel in very difficult times. And when you look at the turmoil and the uncertainty in other parts of Europe and indeed in my own country, Australia, to have such a consistent and stable leadership of the nation through four separate electoral periods is a remarkable thing. And she should be congratulated for that. But yes, there's certainly widespread concern about the rise of the far right just how her new coalition will look.
The Alternative for Germany, AfD as it's called, won 13% of the vote, including nearly 23% in eastern Germany, which is Angela Merkel's home base. A significant increase of some 87 seats.
Yes, and perhaps even more than that, I think. It's not a surprise that the base is in East Germany because in the 20-odd years since reunification, East Germany has clearly struggled still in the transition, much as other Central and East European nations have. And it comes from a tradition and a background where there's less exposure to the competitive pressures of the Western environment.
The publisher-editor of the German weekly Die Zeit said the vote marked a tectonic shift in German politics. The three-way coalition Ms. Merkel looks likely to try to forge will be, quote, highly unstable. What do you think?
Well, it's the claim that it will be unstable rests on the divergent views of the Greens on the one hand and the FDP on the other, a pro-business liberalisation parliamentary perspective, political perspective. So the question for Angela Merkel will be how to harness those two parties that will potentially go in divergent directions. Again, I think it goes back to my first point. Angela Merkel is a remarkable negotiator and a remarkable leader in being able to offer a way forward. And to be blunt, she is supported very well also by a depth of leadership in her own party, the CDU. And I don't just mean the political part of her party, but the intellectual part of her party as well. So if anybody is able to fashion a stable coalition from these parties, then it will be Angela Merkel. And I think the thing that works in favour of stable government is precisely the apparent success of the AfD. The Socialist Party, which had been her coalition partner for the past period of government, has clearly seen that as being to its disadvantage, and it blames its part in the coalition government as the reason for its decline in its vote. So it is going to lead the opposition, and so on the one hand, the new government will have to be alert to the fortunes of the SPD, but on the other hand, I don't think anybody in the government or in those other parties will want to do anything that gives further ammunition to the AfD. So I think you can see that as being a solid basis for a stable government.
Bruce, was the AfD's success tied to the immigration policies of the Merkel government?
Well, that's certainly the reading of commentators who know more about these things than I do. But let me say, looking at a perspective across Europe as a whole, this is not a particularly surprising result, nor do I think that it is a hugely worrying result. If we look at the last 5 years or so, there has clearly been a rise of the far-right parties across Europe, and that's to some degree been a response to the crisis in its neighbourhood in Syria, the burden of refugees in Turkey, and the implications that has for Europe. Now, these are not developments of Europe's making. It's had an impact on Europe clearly, and a massive impact at that. But these are not crises of Europe's making, and Europe has had to manage this. And yet, even with this turmoil, the most that the far right parties have got to in any country is around about 15%. And so you might reasonably think that this is the pinnacle of success for AfD and that it will decline from there.
Bruce Wilson, a professor and director of the European Union Centre at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Iraq's Kurds will be going ahead with a referendum on independence today because Kurdistan Regional Government President Masoud Barzani says their partnership with Baghdad has failed. We asked former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, James Jeffrey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute think tank, if all of this is creating a crisis.
We're in a crisis. And the crisis, the proximate cause of the crisis is Masoud Barzani's desire to go ahead not only with an independence vote, they did one back in 2005 when I was in Iraq, but rather to include disputed areas, particularly the area around oil-rich Kirkuk, which has a mixed Turkoman Arab as well as Kurdish population. That's in a sense people in Baghdad and elsewhere. The second loser, of course, is the United States, because our argument that only we can keep Iraq united has fallen on deaf ears, certainly with Barzani. But at the end of this, there's another thing, Victor, and it's what we've talked about with ISIS and with other issues. Baghdad, since 2003, and actually under Saddam, has been unable to fully integrate the Kurds, and in the case of post-2003 Shia party-led Iraqi governments, the Sunni Arabs, into a vision for a united country with three separate religious ethnic groups. And that's what the Kurds are reacting to. Unwise as this decision is, risky as it is, there is a feeling that Baghdad doesn't listen to them.
Masoud Barzani said that they will never go back to a relationship with Baghdad, adding that Iraq has become a theocratic sectarian state rather than a democracy, as was expected after the overthrow of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein in 2003.
That's an exaggeration. It is a democracy. But again, a majoritarian system there where the majority does not put pressure on the minority is not a happy place. And as I said, Barzani has some real complaints against the Iraqi government. But under Prime Minister Abadi, for example, the Iraqi government has tried to accommodate Barzani. The problem has been the parliament. And frankly, Iran backing those elements of the parliament that don't want to compromise with Kurds, don't want to compromise with Sunni Arabs.
Barzani says today's referendum is going to give Kurdistan's regional government a mandate to negotiate secession and not call for immediate independence.
Right, and that mandate can be interpreted many different ways. The point is, independence doesn't work if you're landlocked and all of the countries around you won't support independence. It's a non-starter, and Barzani knows it. And as soon as Turkey came down so hard as it did on the side of no independence, no referendum, Barzani basically lost his bet.
That's James Jeffrey, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute think tank. On Friday night in the U.S. state of Alabama, where he was campaigning for a candidate for the Senate, President Trump spoke about a number of subjects, including criticism for pro football player Colin Kaepernick, who gained nationwide attention during the 2016 season when he began protesting by not standing while the U.S. national anthem was being played before the start of games. Kaepernick said his actions were motivated by what he viewed as the oppression of people of color in the United States. Mr. Trump had this to say Friday night.
Everyone in this arena tonight are unified by the same great American values. We're proud of our country. We respect our flag. Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
In reaction to President Trump's comments, numerous pro football players knelt during the national anthem at Sunday's many National Football League games. For some reaction to Mr. Trump's comments, VOA's Lori London speaks with Christine Brennan, a sports columnist for USA Today, a commentator on ABC News, CNN, PBS NewsHour, and NPR, also a best-selling author.
Well, Donald Trump really did it this time. I mean, if he's taking on the entire sports establishment, one league, the NFL, the biggest league in the country, and now, of course, the NBA guys as well, I think he may have met his match. Because if anyone has a megaphone that is bigger than Donald Trump, it's the NFL. And these athletes, of course, have huge Twitter followings, and they have followings in red states and blue states. It's not just politics. It's the love of sport. And so as opposed to other people that Donald Trump has bullied and tried to do whatever he's been doing over the last 9 months, these people really can stand up to him and have a following and have support from fans. So this will be very interesting to watch. It's quite a story. Obviously, I'm on it, and it doesn't give me any joy because it's our country. But here we are, and I think it's important to continue to write and talk about it, and I certainly plan to do that.
What do you think the biggest point of all of this is, as far as what do you think the biggest deal about it is? Is it the name-calling? Is it just in general getting involved? Is it that he's going after these people saying they're not patriotic? What really strikes for you?
Well, certainly that horrible tirade in Alabama Friday night where he is attacking a man for exercising his First Amendment right to kneel, Colin Kaepernick. And by the way, Colin Kaepernick is given $1 million in charity, so putting his money where his mouth has been. Peaceful protest, and he is saving far more venom for Kaepernick than, of course, he did for the terrible protesters in Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists, who, of course, were part of a protest and a woman was killed. Wow. You know, my dad couldn't wait to graduate from high school and race to Europe to the end of World War II to fight the Nazis, and so many other people did that as well, and thanks, of course, thank goodness, for them. And to think that Trump can be stronger and more venomous and more angry about a peaceful protest, it's stunning. So I wrote that in USA Today, and I think that's about as big a deal. But now, of course, the protest, Lori, the amount of the athletes, the football players who have been by at least over 100 now, who have knelt or who have done something, some other kind of protest, or the players that haven't even come out for the national anthem, This is a big deal, and if Donald Trump was hoping to get his way, it's kind of the exact opposite. People have really stood up and said, I think more of it's protest right now against Donald Trump, frankly, than about any of the issues that Kaepernick was protesting last year.
Were you surprised by the reaction from the players and the owners and the entire league?
I'm glad to say I'm really not surprised because I've known Roger Goodell for a long time, and certainly he is a subject of a lot of criticism. but I do know him, and it doesn't surprise me that he cares about these issues. And his statement was a repudiation of Donald Trump yesterday. The union, of course, chimed in as well. When you've got the owners and their union doing that, and then, of course, his owners, some of whom supported Donald Trump, telling him basically to mind his own business and to stay out of this. It's I don't know if it's a surprise. It's heartening. And I think everyone, I get tears in my eyes at the national anthem, Lori, when I'm covering the Olympics. So I am someone who stands and proudly stands, but I also proudly defend Colin Kaepernick's right to, and anyone else's right to, kneel or do whatever they want. That's the beauty of the United States. And so if you feel that way, I think you probably have to be heartened. I'm obviously a journalist who gives my opinion. People can feel what they want. But looking at this from a sports journalist perspective, I think it's a heartening American reaction today to appalling words by the President of the United States the other day.
Christine Brennan, she is a sports columnist for USA Today, also a commentator on ABC News, CNN, PBS NewsHour, and NPR, as well as a best-selling author. And she was speaking with my colleague, Lori London.
What is it like to study in the United States? Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This is Banned Books Week here in the United States, an annual event that points out censorship and emphasizes the freedom to read. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to a bookstore where customers are searching for books that they want to read.
Here at the Duende District Bookstore in Washington, customer Katie Schwartz is on a mission to complete her collection of the 6 free banned books. They are wrapped in black paper and hidden among other books for sale.
This is the one. This is the last one. Yay. I need. Thank you.
I had 4 of the books when I came in, which means I only needed 2 more. And the very, very first one that I opened was one that I haven't seen anywhere else.
Since no books are banned in Washington, Schwartz finds it hard to believe it is happening in the United States at all.
It's an American right to be able to express yourself in however you see fit, and it's also an American right to avoid things by choice that you don't agree with. And books are something that are very easily avoided if you don't agree with them.
Customer Lyric Prince comes across Fahrenheit 451, a science fiction novel where books are outlawed in American society, and any found are burned by firemen. Some people object to the profanity or burning of a Bible in the story. Prince is not surprised that some books, like this novel published more than 60 years ago, are still banned today.
A lot of places in this country don't exactly take kindly to progressive ideas.
At this public library in Washington, Linnea Hegarty, head of the D.C. Public Library Foundation, says those ideas may include political issues or sexual orientation. Among the groups sponsoring Banned Books Week is the American Library Association, which puts out an annual list of the 10 most challenged books, a formal attempt to remove material from a library or school curriculum. And the good news is that very few books ever actually get banned. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency is getting ready for their next bed rest study, which involves subjects staying in bed for 60 days. ESA scientists want to find out if a mix of antioxidants and vitamins might help astronauts fight the side effects of living in space. The study is meant to mimic changes astronauts must endure in space. While going to bed might seem like a nice, restful experiment to sign up for, keep in mind that test subjects must keep at least one shoulder on their bed at all times for 60 days. And the bed they'll lie in will have the head end tilted down 6 degrees for the entire time, something that can make blood and fluids move to the head. So, would you sign up for this test? I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department, some really cool music.
Hey,
Cool and the Gang is an American funk and rhythm and blues band that was popular in the 1970s and 80s and still tours today to huge crowds, making music like their 1983 hit, Joanna. In 1964, teenager Robert Bell and his brother Ronald, along with five high school friends, formed an instrumental band they called the Jazziacs. They changed their name to Cool in the Flames in 1967, then Cool in the Gang in 1969. The band consisted of Robert and Ronald Bell, Robert Mickens, Dennis Thomas, Ricky West, George Brown, and Charles Smith. Cool and the Gang has sold over 70 million albums worldwide and inspired music of three generations. Thanks to songs like their hit Cherish, they've earned two Grammy Awards, seven American Music Awards, 25 top 10 R&B hits, nine top 10 pop hits, and 31 gold and platinum albums. Gang has performed continuously for the past 45 years, longer than any R&B group in history. Four of the original band members, Robert and Ronald Bell, George Brown, and Dennis Thomas, are still out there on the road touring the world. Always at the top of their playlist is the 1980 super hit Celebration. Of course, we're celebrating because you're listening to us here on the Voice of America, an international edition. Good to have you with us today. Latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday and enjoy the rest of Cool in the Gang.
We gonna celebrate your party with you. Come on now.
Celebrate and have a good time. Celebrate. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. President Donald Trump and U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley, joined leaders of 127 United Nations member states in supporting reform of the international body in a recent U.S.-hosted event. The nations pledged support for Secretary General Antonio Guterres' reform agenda, calling for reform in the pillars of peace and security, development, and management reform. They signed a 10-point declaration committing to strong partnerships in this matter and stronger collaboration in mandate delivery overall. The United Nations was founded on truly noble goals, said President Trump. Yet in recent years, the United Nations has not reached its full potential because of bureaucracy and mismanagement. We commend the Secretary General and his call for the United Nations to focus more on people and less on bureaucracy.
We seek a United Nations that regains the trust of the people around the world. In order to achieve this, the United Nations must hold every level of management accountable, protect whistleblowers, and focus on results rather than on process.
The 10-point plan called for a reduction in redundancy throughout and across the United Nations system and greater transparency and predictability in its planning and budget functions. The declaration also called for concrete changes in the United Nations system to better align its work on humanitarian response, development, and sustaining peace initiatives.
To honor the people of our nations, we must ensure that no one and no member state shoulders a disproportionate share of the burden, and that's militarily or financially. We also ask that every peacekeeping mission have clearly defined goals and metrics for evaluating success.
We pledge to be partners in your work, said President Trump, and I am confident that if we work together and champion truly bold reforms, the United Nations will emerge as a stronger, more effective, more just, and greater force for peace and harmony in the world. The U.S. hopes to bring the United Nations to complete consensus on these goals and calls on some 70 remaining member states to sign the declaration, said Ambassador Haley. In the coming weeks and months, we will be considering the Secretary General's broader vision. This is an opportunity for all of us to seize this moment and ensure that the United Nations remains relevant. Let's make it a new day at the United Nations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.